Welcome to Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor, your one-stop shop when it comes to animation news and commentary. I'm Drew's co-host, entertainment writer Jim Hill, and Mr. Taylor and I are recording this show on Thursday, August 8th, 2019. And are we of the same mind in regard to the Addams Family trailer that just dropped?
Or? I mean, just disbelief, mostly, or what mindset are you in right now?
I think it was better than the last one. I'm still a little concerned about, I don't know if it's the art direction or the rendering. It's kind of startling.
Yeah, but, it looks a little unfinished.
Yeah.
And this thing is coming out like soon, so.
On the other hand, I liked some of the gags. I liked, I don't know. I want this to work. I really do. I have to admit, I like some of the individual gags. It was, the one of, they're driving into New Jersey and the state motto is, "What are you looking at?"
Right.
but to put the Addams Family in suburbia?
Yeah, it's just, it's very confusing because it's like they're in suburbia, but they're in the same house in suburbia. It just didn't. It didn't make a lot of sense to me, but who knows? We don't have a Hotel Transylvania movie to watch this year, so maybe it'll scratch that itch.
Okay.
How do we feel about Snoop Dogg being Cousin It?
I was talking with Alice about this, and she was like, "Well, I like the design. I like the hair and the cane, and and the little hat. It's just sort of like okay, but." Boy, it's always concerning to me when you have to treat a trailer like a buffet. It's just, I like that, and I like that, but,
right.
It's like...
It's interesting how these animated movies feel like they have to have, almost a rapper being part of these animated movies has become its own trope, in a way. Yeah. Like, Tyler, the Creator, was part of Grinch. We had Pharrell, obviously, a part of the Despicable Me series. It's kind of interesting in that way that is kind of a box they have to check off.
I guess, face it. So much of the launching of these movies is who's going to go on Good Morning America? Who's going to go on Kimmel? Who's going to go on Fallon? Just making sure that in that week to 10 days, running up to the release of the movie, you're doing everything to raise its profile and make sure you can get as many people as possible to turn out. And I don't know. It's just, I like seeing as many animators as possible employed and big fan of the original Charles Addams New Yorker cartoons and, really want this to work. But it just, face it, you and I both know that when you put together a trailer, you go through the entire film and try to pull out your strongest elements, the stuff that, will really compel, people to come out. And it's just sort of like, and as you said, we're just weeks out. And this was it,
Yeah. Yeah, I don't get it. I don't know. I love the Barry Sonnenfeld movies, too, and those feel very cartoony to me.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
In the best way. But I'm not sure. But I forgot to tell you this. I actually talked to Guillermo del Toro earlier this week about Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Oh, cool!
And I had to ask him about Haunted Mansion. And he said, that there were at least two or three scripts that I would have directed, and they just never wanted to greenlight it. And I got him to confirm that Ryan Gosling was going to star in one of those versions. If I had had more time, I would have asked him about Disney Double Dare You, which I still want to do a big feature on before Halloween. We should do that.
I agree. It's kind of ironic because we're coming up on the D23 Expo. And remember, that was where, at the very first Expo, that was what they walked out. Our brand new bold initiative. And, here we are doing stuff with Guillermo del Toro. And
How many executives ago was that, though, Joe? That was the Dick Cook era, I believe,
that
right?
That was. It still kind of breaks my heart that Dick basically got fired because of, what he did for that first D23 Expo. That, you know, he brought all of these celebrities down, but you didn't necessarily allow Disney PR to promote the fact that, you know, what was Travolta and Robin Williams and hell, the appearance of Johnny Depp in full costume as Jack Sparrow on stage, you know, to announce
Pirates 4, I think.
I want to say, yeah, the Stranger Tides.
Yeah.
But yeah, that they were furious with him because they felt that he didn't play ball. And next thing you know, he's out the door. So,
What were you going to ask me about Guillermo?
Oh, was this for his star in Hollywood Boulevard? Or?
It was right after. He had just gotten a star, and then he walked over to the junket, and we talked for about 10 minutes about scary stories. And it's coming out this Friday, so if you want to get a little pre-Halloween goose, you can go watch that. It's very fun. But considering you haven't seen Lion King or Toy Story 4 yet,
Are you just waiting
for the DVDs on that one?
This is the summer of I don't get out much. All right, that will be changing soon. But interesting that you brought up pre-Halloween, because what is it? They just started doing the DCA Halloween event, the hard ticket after hours, right?
They previewed it last week for journalists. I was not invited. I mean, take that as you will. But
we're making friends left and right.
Right. I think that starts in September. But they ran the full new World of Color. And then last night and tonight, I think, are the Haunted Mansion After Hours event at Disneyland, which for the low, low price of $300, you have access to the park from 1 to 4 in the morning, and they do some, like, live things, and I don't know. I couldn't justify it. I'm a married man now, Jim. You know, I gotta watch my budget.
You have a small, adorable dog to feed.
I know.
Just the toys alone, you know, will eat into that feed.
I know. I can't take kibble out of her mouth. But the big thing was that your friend and mine, Eric Goldberg, created this new character for the new World of Color Halloween show, which is sort of interesting.
Villainous, I think is the name of it. So what is it? Shelley Marie, who is supposedly a play on Mary Shelley, the author of the original Frankenstein. But you and I were talking, so we were pre-gaming today, that this is not Eric's first theme park exclusive thing that...
Yeah, I can't believe I got to educate you on one of his very bizarre projects.
Oh, well, I don't know if educate is quite the word I would use. All right, please explain, because that this is going to be an eye-opener for a lot of folks.
I think so. So in 2015, for the 20th anniversary of Food and Wine in Epcot, they had Eric create and animate a series of new characters that were sort of that Food and Wine's mascots, and they were different taste buds, and they were in commercials, and they were on signage in the park, and nobody really knew it was him. They didn't really advertise it. I only know because I went to lunch with him one day, and he said, you know, by the way, I made these characters that are in the park right now. And that, so, I mean, I think it's okay to talk about now because it's so long ago, but, at another press event when I was with your dear ex-wife, now current co-host, we were sitting there talking to Eric, and he said, oh, yeah, I'm doing animation for the Happily Ever After projection show, because I guess the hand-drawn animation has to be a little bit reconfigured for projection mapping. So I'm sure he also did one for the – what is the show at Hollywood Studios right now? Like Celebration of Animation or whatever that show is.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah, so I'm sure he had to do some stuff for that, too. But, I mean, he's one of the only people left at Disney doing hand-drawn, I guess, in, like, what is that department called that he's in, Jim? You know what I'm talking about. It's, like, it's special projects or something.
Yeah. You know, it's literally like taking Leonardo da Vinci and making him make sandwiches. I mean, you, for example, and this has got to be, like, 10 years old at this point, did you see like the proof of concept thing that he did for Wreck-It Ralph, where he just hand animated the character, you know, to sort of prove that, okay, that this look and
amazing. Absolutely. Yeah. Amazing.
But it just, I keep hoping especially on the heels of Disney Plus, that the door will open again for hand-drawn, because it just seems like, you know, we are so long overdue for, you know, that return.
I mean, if you go into his office, you'll see a lot of artwork from shorts that he's pitched and were ultimately rejected, and also material from the third Fantasia that he was working on, that he said that he pitched so many ideas for the third Fantasia that they were calling it internally the Goldberg variations, because he had so many pitches. Yeah, so hopefully some of that stuff will see the light of day. Obviously, Fantasia 2000 had been in the works for decades before that was actually produced. But yeah, he's great. He's a great animator and a great guy.
No, I don't. Absolutely. Though, the weird thing is, when he stepped away from Disney and was directing, there were so many projects he was associated with. I mean, the Curious George movie that didn't get made, the Where the Wild Things movie that got made. Was either of the Garfield theatricals, was he ever associated with those? Or?
I'm not sure. I know he did the Looney Tunes Back in Action, which...
Yeah.
He still defends to this day.
I understand. I understand. Looney Tunes Back in Action is worth it alone for the commentary track and the cutscenes. You really get a sense of the movie that was almost there.
Oh, really? I'm gonna have to track down the Blu-ray now.
Yeah, but speaking of Garfield, what did you make of the Viacom acquisition this week? Because this is interesting. This isn't Viacom producing a new series of Garfield cartoons, you know, a new animated series. This is literally Viacom acquiring the character.
Yeah, well, you were telling me about what is it, the legal kind of ramifications of this?
Well, I mean, what's strange, I guess, is that Jim Davis, the creator of Garfield, has retained the rights to the comic strip, but it's Viacom going forward now that decides what happens with this character. And I can't help but, you know, look at this and wonder, are we kind of in sort of the same territory with what just happened with Apple and Peanuts? You know, the whole notion of, okay, you know, here's a well-known worldwide character that we could potentially do something with. But to have, you know, these giant corporations grab these sets of characters and then look to, you know, is this for shorts that's going to be streamed? Is this for feature? You know, I mean, there's a lot of questions out there now.
It also reminds me of Netflix doing the Dr. Seuss stuff, which we're going to see the first of that, I think, by the end of the year.
Really?
I think Green Eggs and Ham is going to be there by the end of the year, but... Yeah, I mean, have we talked about, like, Paramount and their animation situation at length?
Well, I mean,
that could be a whole episode, but you and I both know that they've tried again and again to try to get this off the ground, and I don't think it's for theatrical stuff, because I don't think Viacom and Paramount are on that good of terms. So I would imagine it's some kind of either for CBS All Access, maybe, or something along the, or for television, for terrestrial television, something like a SpongeBob companion or something. But
yeah,
I don't know.
What's so strange, and you've got to be getting this sense when you sit down and talk with people out west, you know, this whole notion of, you know, everybody sort of looking over their shoulder at the Netflix and the Hulus and again the Disney Pluses and the CBS All Accesses, and you know, and how it's changing the business model in so many different directions. I mean, you know, I can't help but, you know, for example, this week Cartoon Network is running Infinity Train. It's a 5-night event is how they've been promoting it, and Alice and I are 6 episodes in at this point, and I won't lie that this Owen Dennis, he's a writer and a storyboard artist from the regular show. It started a little wobbly, but it's definitely growing on me. It's this fascinating piece about a girl who was supposed to be going to, I guess, gaming camp, and her parents have divorced, and there was a miscommunication, and her dad can't take her to Oshkosh. I forget where it was the gaming conference is supposed to be, and through machinations that are too difficult to describe at this point, she ends up on this giant, bizarre train where each train car is a world unto itself. And, you know, you, Drew, especially with your small but great dog, Nova, would love the fact that one of the main characters of this is a talking corgi who's the king of Corgi Land.
I'm very into that. Yeah. I remember, and he was in the short, too, right?
I believe so, yeah. Yeah. But again, it's you know, face it, I think we talked in a previous show about how this had been pitched, or at least talked up as sort of the next, you know, Over the Garden Wall. And it, I won't lie, it doesn't have that richness that Over the Garden Wall did. But like I said, it's grown on me. But at the same time, the notion of, okay, so this is a 5-night event, you know, and each night they show 2 15-minute-long chapters. So, you know, when this thing is done, there's going to be 2.5 hours of this story told. And, you know, I just, when you think about the Disney deal from a week to 10 days ago, where they, what is it, 17 different artists landed deals to produce stuff for Disney Plus.
Well, they landed deals to produce for TV animation. That animation goes, mm-hmm. we will see. But yes, I think all signs point to Disney Plus.
But it's such a strange time that things just seem so fluid now, and where something hits or lands or connects. Well, we were just talking, for example, as we were pre-gaming about the short that's going to be in front of Angry Birds 2 when it comes out later this month, Hair Love.
Yeah, we're very excited about that.
I love the art that's out there. To, you know, I would sit in just for the tutorial about how they actually did the hair.
And what's interesting about that, too, is that it was an independent short that was acquired by Sony Animation. Mm-hmm. I think it was like kickstarted and crowdfunded and all that. And then they were like, we will take this on and put it in front of Angry Birds 2, the most commercial title you could think of, right?
Yeah. But can you talk a little bit about who's behind this one?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because it's a combination of people, including one of our favorite animators around, Bruce Smith. Mm-hmm. Who, as we know, and what we will do a, did we already, we didn't do a Bebe's Kids episode yet, did we?
No, I am prepping it. It's a great story, you know, especially when you drill down into the actual routine. It's based on a trip to Disneyland, so that makes the film that much more fun. But
he's one of the directors, and then mm-hmm. Everett Downing Jr., who was a longtime animator at Pixar, who worked on Up, WALL-E, Brave, etc., and then a former NFL player named Matthew Cherry, who came up with the story and is co-directing it, which is really cool.
Okay, now Angry Birds 2 drops in theaters when? Is that this weekend?
It's not this
weekend. No, August 14th. Okay. Yes.
They played it last Saturday as part of an early screening promotion with Target, which you didn't go to because you don't leave the house anymore. I understand that, but but we'll get to see Angry Birds 2 and Hair Love soon, I'm sure, mm-hmm. the both of us, and we'll talk at length about it.
So that was supposed to have the window clear shot, you know, audience all to itself, starting on August 14th. And then coming roughly 2 weeks later was supposed to be the Playmobil, the movie.
Right. And not anymore.
Not anymore. So this, you know, got pushed all the way back to December 6th, which is, as you were pointing out again, as we're pre-gaming, that, what, 2 weeks after Frozen 2?
Yeah.
So, you know, because again, oh, that film will be out of gas by then. Absolutely. You know,
right.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm not sure the thinking. I mean, you and I both have heard the stories about STX being mm-hmm. in trouble, and they've had mm-hmm. to sort of shuffle and, you know, reposition films recently. But they've got this new Jennifer Lopez stripper movie coming out called Hustlers, which they think is going to be a big hit. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that'll kind of re-energize them. But one of the reasons they're in such dire straits financially is the Ugly Dolls movie, which, you know, came out earlier this year, was fully financed by STX, and was just a huge bomb. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting how animation is kind of, like, taken such a large role in STX's future slash, you know, current standing. But, I mean, I think we both agree that the Playmobil movie looks cute. Oddly enough, was directed by the supervising animator of Frozen, so... That'll be an interesting showdown.
I mean, that's the other thing. I just, you know, just sort of, that's got to have been a tough conversation that we're going to move it to behind Frozen 2. Speaking of Ugly Dolls, did you see that essay that Kelly Asbury put out?
No. Oh, on Cartoon Brew about directing back-to-back bombs?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I have to admit, it was kind of refreshing to have somebody talk about having that experience, because that's honestly the hard reality of Hollywood, that not everything is going to be a Frozen, you know, a billion-dollar blockbuster phenomenon. Though in Kelly's case, what was it? Smurfs The Lost Village was his. Mm-hmm. And I remember I got to sit down with him at Sony, and he walked me through the original version of the movie, which I guess then from when he and I talked to when it came out, the story changed 3 and 4 different times. And, you know, but that's just kind of the way it is when you deal with these corporate properties.
What was the, you want to tell us about the original version?
Well, I mean, you know, the weird thing is it was at that point, it was a time travel story. It was literally that they traveled back to, you know, how the Smurfs were originally and how Gargamel was. And there was definitely an intriguing story there. And God, the concept paintings were amazing. And, you know, but again, I think, you know, Kelly is, you know, a realist. You know, he you know, that's the thing. You are given the opportunity to direct these films, but at the same time, it's somebody else's toy box you're in, and you can have a good solid story, but you know you then have to go to, you know, the folks who own the Smurfs, and it's like, no, that's not the direction we want to go. Or, you know, same thing with the Ugly Doll folks. And I don't know, I just,
great director, he's a great guy, great director.
Yeah
that post has been taken down from Cartoon Brew, by the way, so I hope everyone got a chance to read.
Really?
Yeah, I just looked for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, okay. All right, what else have we got for news since we've been away? And again, you know, talking on the corporate side of things here, folks, we saw Fox, and again, this is the new Fox Corporation, what remains of Fox after Disney did its $71.3 billion acquisition and walked off with the film library and all sorts of assets. But
is it so confusing how they are referring to these things in the news? Like, I have to read every article to see, is this a Disney Fox thing or a Fox thing?
See, that's initially when I heard that Bento Box was being bought by Fox. And again, Bento Box are the folks who do Bob's Burgers. I said, oh, cool. Okay. Yeah. You know, but, you know, it just sort of, okay, so, you know, Bento Box is going to Disney. It's like, no, this is not Bento Box. This is, you know, or this is not Disney. This is the new Fox.
New Fox.
The new, yeah. Newly slimmed down. And the notion, and again, it just, what's interesting, if you drill down into the story, you have all of this talk about how Fox felt that in its new slimmed down form, it needed an animation studio. And they enjoyed, you know, what Bento Box did. They like, you know, how, you know, in fact, what's fascinating is if you look at, you know, Bob's Burgers, it's now run on FX, and you can catch a season one and line it up against a season 9, and to watch the really smart ways they've stepped up the look of it, You know, it's still all of One Piece, but there's some wonderful art direction now that keeps the world consistent, but at the same time richer.
I'm wondering, you know, Bento Box is like a half a mile away from where I live. It's right,
is it really?
It's right on Lancashire in North Hollywood. It's actually in the same building where Disney Interactive used to be. So there you go. It's all connected, Jim. Everything we talk about.
On the other hand, you and I have talked before about the wonderful work that Titmouse does. And have you managed to see yet Mau Mau, Heroes of Pure Heart over at Cartoon Network?
I've seen a little bit of it. As you know, I turn on cartoons when I leave the apartment for the dog, so I've seen a little bit of it then. But the animation is really beautiful. And so fluid, and I love it.
Well, but it's not just that. It has great writing, wonderful character voices. I mean, Alice and I were binging a bunch of them last night, and it's so smart. It's so fun. It hits that wonderful Venn diagram where, you know, it's a great show for kids, but at the same time, there's enough smart dialogue and great fun character stuff going on that, you know, as an adult sitting there, you know, you can enjoy it as well. But again, yeah, they just sort of, if you think about all the stuff that Titmouse does in so many different styles, and that's, you know, half the fun of this is, you know, sort of an American spin on anime. And
it's interesting that took so long to develop too, because the original pilot aired on March 6th, 2014.
Wow, really?
Yeah. Okay. And then they reworked the pilot, showed another one in February of 2017, and now the show is finally here. But not all shows are getting a full commitment, though, as you told me right before we started.
In fact, again, this was kind of a shock today. I mean, right on the heels of their crossover episode with Sonic, right? Okay, KO, you know, just revealed today that they're ending their run after three seasons. And again, you know, a wonderfully written show, great style, but man, I'm gonna just so many things lately seem to be doing the three and done for some reason. It's just sort of, it used to be the magic number was what, 65 episodes or?
Yeah, I think 65 or 66, so that you could run each one every day.
There you go.
But it'll end with 101 episodes, but those are 15-minute. Episodes,
well, there we go.
Right?
There we go.
Yeah, it's going to be... So I really like that show, too. It's very charming. It's got a great animation style, like you said. Mm-hmm. The end theme song by our favorite, Rebecca Sugar, wrote
there
that.
There you go.
It's sad.
The show creator just today put out this message. Please don't spread the rumor that it was my choice to end OK, KO, Let's Be Heroes. It wasn't. However, Cartoon Network gave us the bad news early enough that we're able to spend this season doing our planned ending. I'm proud of what we're making and can't wait for you to see it. So, I guess you got to take the good with the bad. At least they're going out the way they wanted in this story.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the number of episodes, it was less of a shock than we thought it was, because they went from, they did 53 episodes for the first season in less than a year. Oh. And then the second season was 38 episodes, again, an insane amount of episodes, a little over a year. And then the third season, 20 episodes. So maybe the writing was on the wall, but doesn't make it any less sad.
I guess so. But it just, you know, it's so often when, you know, you get to visit these studios and you walk into the office with that flow chart showing what show is at what point in, you know, the its production phase, and see that it's, you know, that kind of air traffic controller to O'Hare moment where it's like, you know, 20 different episodes in production at any one time at, you know, various different stages of completion. And, you know, again, you get why a Rebecca Sugar or, you know, that sort of thing was like, I have to step away. It's lovely to get the chance to create this stuff, but, you know, you want to actually also have a life.
Yeah. I mean, you hear those stories about Alex Hirsch, like, living in his office and things like that. It's like, Yeah, these things take a toll.
Yeah, I guess they do. Speaking of which, though, when Drew and I get back from this commercial break, we're going to talk about a Disney film that you wouldn't necessarily think was, you know, or difficult or a trial to make, but really turned out to be a bear. It's kind of ironic because the film features a deer.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Anyway, we're back. Let's talk about Bambi, Drew, because today, the day this podcast goes live, which, what is it, the 13th, right? The 13th of 2019. Okay, so on this day back in 1942, Bambi had its premiere in New York City, which kind of ironic because I don't understand. The film 4 days earlier had its premiere in London, which, you know, again, this is the middle of World War II, and it's just sort of like, really? You're going to go over to the place that's being bombed? And like, do your premiere there? Okay, that's interesting. Anyway, on the heels of this anniversary, I did some drilling down into the story of Bambi, and particularly the Disney version, and there's, you know, I mean, it's in a weird sort of way, it's this great story of hubris on Walt's part, because, okay, so picture this, Drew. It's April of 1937. Snow White is like 6 months out, 8 months out from its Hollywood premiere in December. And Walt is just now kind of flashing on the point, like, well, holy cow, we're going to finish this, and we're going to actually do more of these feature-length projects, and we should really maybe be looking around for other stuff to make movies based on. And he, you know, the Felix Salten's book, Bambi, A Life in the Woods, is brought to his attention. Now, that this was initially published back in Austria back in 1923, and it took 5 years before there was an English translation. Simon & Schuster released it in 1928, and even then, you know, just it kind of hung out there. Nobody approached the project until 1933, where MGM snaps up the film rights. But, you know, and they try for a number of years to see if they can maybe do it as a live-action film. And but it turns out, you know, live-action deer don't take direction.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, other than perhaps to eat the flowers in your yard. You know, so it was one of these things where they were anxious to sort of just get rid of the project. And so, you know, Walt reached out to MGM and said, hey, would you be interested in selling us the rights? And MGM at that point is sort of looking over its shoulder, and it's like, yeah, last year, 36, that's when the Nazis decided that this was a book that they were going to ban, because supposedly, you know, Hitler thought of Bambi as an allegory for how the Jews were treated in Europe. Seriously, that this was evidently the thinking at the time. And so they're like, oh, sure, yes, absolutely, Walt. You want to buy this book? Go right ahead. And, you know, so Walt comes through the door and say, hey, look what I got for our second film after Snow White. It's Bambi. I got Life in the Woods. And the animators are like, what? And he says, no, don't worry about it. Think about it. We've already done Deer. I mean, you know, look, in Snow White, her little forest friends, we'll just take everything we learned from doing the cute little fuzzy peak, you know, animals who come through the door and wash the dishes and sweep the floor, and we'll use them, you know, as our template to make this next movie. And, you know, and all the guys are just trying to get Snow White done at this time, and they're like, okay, Walt, whatever. And meanwhile, he's looking around for the second film, and, you know, or a film to follow Bambi. And September of 1937, Norm Ferguson brings in a translated version of Carlo Collodi's The Adventures of Pinocchio, and he shows it to Walt. And Walt, you know, but the weird thing is, Walt initially looks at Pinocchio and goes, oh, I know what we can do with this. This is, you know, we're going to do Pinocchio as if he's Charlie McCarthy.
Really?
A wise, cracking, talking puppet in the style of Edgar Bergen's ventriloquist dummy. I mean, seriously, that's, if you know, if you ever get into back into the ARL, the Animation Research Library, the early stuff for Pinocchio, where it was kind of, you know, I mean, because face it, in the original book, he is kind of a smartass, obnoxious character. They were looking for doing a much more lighthearted, show-busy kind of a story.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. It's where they started, not necessarily the film that they wanted to, you know, the film they eventually wound up making. Anyway, Snow White opens December of 37, goes wide, you know, or goes into its nationwide release in February of 1938. And at this point, Disney is still talking up Bambi as it's going to be released to theaters just 16 months later. It's going to be out in theaters in June of 1939, which, as they begin to actually take a look at the book, and now I know, I think on a previous show, we talked about how dark and strange The Fox and the Hound got, you know, the original storyline for the, you know, the Disney feature from, what was it, 83, 84?
Right.
But Bambi, oh my God. There are some things in the original story of Bambi that, for example, you know how Bambi eventually, his mate at the end of the film, Feline. Did you know that Feline, at least in the original book, had a brother called Gobo?
No.
All right. At one point in the book, you know, men enter the forest and they kill, and in fact, as part of the scene where Bambi's mom is killed, Gobo disappears and is presumed dead. He eventually comes back. It turns out he was saved by a man, and who brought him home and tamed him. And so Gobo is like, no, men are great. I really, you know, this is, you know, I enjoyed my time with them. They fed me and they gave me this wonderful harness to wear. And, you know, and so later in the story, when Gobo sees that men are back in the forest, he then approaches the men because he thinks of all men as family and or friendly, and they then cut him down.
Wow.
Yeah, there are so many scenes where you read this thing, and it's like, you know, for example, at one point Bambi gets shot, and the prince of the forest, his dad, finds him and then teaches him to walk in a circle, so that way they confuses the hunter and his dogs, and more to the point, it gives him time to, you know, sort of till the bleeding stops so that he, you know, can then recover. But there's one moment where, you know, the old prince brings, you know, Bambi to, that they discover the corpse of a man who's been killed by another hunter. And, you know, just to the effect of, you know, it just look, they're not all powerful. They actually, you know, will take each other out. And it just, it has so many of these dark, weird twists to it that, you know, what's interesting is if you go to the authorized Disney histories, you know, what they talk about is why Bambi was delayed from June of 1939 to all the way to August of 42, was like, oh, we were trying to do our best possible, you know, anatomically correct animals. And, you know, the hard reality was that it was a lot of this story stuff. It was that Bambi, when you got right down to it, was so dark and so weird. In fact, finally, they got to the point where, okay, we think we figured out the story. So, but this is now July of 1940. And, you know, just a few months before Pinocchio arrives in theaters. And it, you know, obviously they switched the batting order up. But even as it went into production, it's now the war years when, you know, the studio really has no money. And in order to get Bambi in workable shape that they have enough money to, you know, to finally make this movie, you know, Walt is basically told, it's like, look, you got to lose 12 minutes. You know, you got to cut this thing down. And what's interesting is that, you know, so the end runtime for Bambi is 70 minutes. Now, when you compare that to Snow White, which was 82 minutes, and Pinocchio, which was 88, I want to say Bambi is the second shortest in I think Dumbo at 64 minutes is the shortest.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of stuff that got thrown out. And there was a musical number called Twitterpated. There was a grasshopper character that got chopped out that they fed a lot of the lines to Friend Owl with. And the interesting thing is that one of the cuts, a relatively short cut, but I've actually seen the art for this. You know how, again, everyone talks about how sophisticated, what a sophisticated story choice it was that Bambi's mom gets killed off camera? They boarded it, Drew.
Oh, I've seen that, where they, like, have a conversation as she's dying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of like, you know, it's just sort of like, have we traumatized the children in the audience enough? No. Let's let mom talk as she dies.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know. I mean, it's just, for me, you know, it just, I face it, you know, it's 70 plus years after the fact. You know, it's, you know, when you look at examples, you know, for one, you know, so much of the wonderful work that Teehee did on the project, you know, the stylization. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's a good, solid piece of work. But at the same time, when you take into consideration, you know, just where Walt started from, like, oh, we got this. We've already done animals. And if you think back to the cute little squirrels and bunnies that, you know, clean dishes and, you know, swept floors and that sort of thing, you know, they could have never carried a movie, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, the other thing I wanted to say was that everyone should look up that PBS special about Tyrus Wong. Do you remember that from a couple years ago?
Yeah.
Absolutely beautiful documentary about one of the key concept artists for Bambi. Mm-hmm. His watercolors really inspired the movie if they weren't used directly. But he is an absolutely legendary artist. And that documentary, I thought, was just so sweet. And so moving, I just thought it was terrific. You saw that, right?
Oh yeah, I mean, it just, you know, that if you've never wanted to make a kite after you see this thing, you know, it just, you know,
I would give for one of those kites. I mean, it's amazing.
But no, I just I don't know. It's just, for me, it's just fascinating, you know, how Walt decided what we're going to be, you know, the films that Disney was going to go, you know, going forward. And, you know, during this same period, he he makes the arrangements to get his hands on, cuts the deal with the hospital in London to get Peter Pan, likewise Alice. And there's all this amazing concept art that's done during this period. But at the same time, the war starts up and there's no money, and, how many of them get pushed off. And, you got to wonder, what would a Bambi have looked like if with Peter Pan or Alice in Wonderland, they've been pushed off by almost 10 years or thereabouts. I mean, you kind of hope that, all that amazing work that, Tyrus did would have stayed in the film. But if you look at those latter features and how, Walt just sort of embraced what Mary Blair was doing, and, what she painted, the way she drew, drove the look of those movies.
Yeah. It's really interesting, and especially when you read the Neil Gabler bio, just how that schedule was being shifted all the time. And, it was really interesting what the pre-war and post-war studio looked like. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, Bambi's still great. Also, when I was in my mother's stomach, she called me Thumper because I kicked so much. So there's my connection to Bambi.
Well, okay. Another unlikely story.
This is what you only get with me, Jim. All right? You're not hearing Dan Z talk about his, prenatal existence. It's only me.
I was lucky enough to meet your mom this past December at you and Katie's engagement party, and God, she was such a kick.
She's a pip
All right, well, anyway, folks, that brings us to the tail end of another fine tuning here. Drew, if people enjoyed the stories you tell here, where else can they find you online?
Well, you can, find me on Movie Phone every day. You can listen to Light the Fuse, the Mission Impossible podcast, which is still going strong. You can also listen to my episode of the Collider podcast, where I talk about how John Carter was originally a Pixar film. It's a very interesting hour, long conversation there. I'm sure, Jim, you would appreciate it. I'll send you a link. And cool. That's about it. But here we go. Here comes the Jim Hill podcast roll.
Okay, go. Let's see. Well, we got Disney Dish with Len Testa. We got Universal Joint with Dustin Fuse. We got Looking at Lucasfilm with Dan Z. We got Marvel Us Disney with the amazing Aaron Adams. And recording tomorrow, okay, I swear to God, is I Want That with Michelle Valladolid. In fact, we were just looking at a pile of Wishables, which is these new
so plush. Stupid. Those are so stupid.
Well, blind, you heard it
blind,
here for
blind me. Bag. I hope you guys go through all the Haunted Mansion stuff this week.
I
there's
don't know.
So much stuff.
I know, but see, that's the problem. These events that are driven by merch. I have to admit, there are people who do some amazing work, and there's lovely individual pieces, but it just especially what we talked about at the top of the show, a $300 price point, and that's just to get in the door?
Yeah.
And then you have to buy the merch?
Yeah. I think the only question our listeners are wanting before we go is, did you finish Stranger Things?
Yes. Okay. Yes. In fact, do you think they're going to go for four?
I think they're going to go for... I think four will be it, though.
Okay.
Yeah, I saw a rumor that it's going to take place at Christmas 1986. That'll be the setting of the next one. But I thought this third season was the best yet. I don't know how you felt.
Well, I have to admit, that I think we've talked about this, that when you're enjoying something, you're willing to forgive a multitude of sins. And, it's like the literally people's lives are at stake. But let's for 3 minutes, let's do the Never-Ending Story theme song.
You got to admit, that was pretty cute, though.
It was pretty cute. But at the same time, it's sort of like, Winona Ryder in a Russian, you know, soldier's uniform, you know, stretching her arms out, trying to turn two keys at the exact same time. And it's just sort of like, okay, all right, you know, if I could forgive Indiana Jones on the outside of a submarine crossing an entire ocean, I can overlook this. It was so much fun. It was so well done. But and having grown up, you know, or excuse me, I was an adult, fully upright, in the 1980s. God, they got so much of it right. That mall was so scary. Oh my God!
You were happy to see it destroyed by a giant monster.
There we go. That's it exactly. Yeah. So, you know, well, but all right, Christmas '86. Okay, yeah.
That's the rumor.
Okay. Well, all right. Let's hope that pans out. And you know, maybe we'll have more info by the time we record a new show. But until then, folks, thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.